Jancha badura ne kyapsu chi nage chunye gipe sonam ge drola penshi sange drupa shu chedan songe chonam la jancha badura ne kyapsu chi nage chunye gipe sonam ge Drola penche sange drupa shu. Chedan songe chonam la janchu badu dani kyapsu chi. Nange chenye gipe sonam gi. Drola penche sange drupa shu.
Yesterday, Geshe-la reviewed the steps of the path that are shared with those of small capacity and those that are shared with those of medium capacity. So today we're going to go into the steps of the path of those of the great capacity. Now, it is very likely that you are already familiar with the steps of the Path to Enlightenment of beings of the from the three scopes, but it's good to mention nonetheless that our final destination is the state of a Buddha. Although we begin with following in sequence the steps of the path of those of the small scope, then of the medium scope, still one need to consider that our final destination is the state of a Buddha. Otherwise, if we do not begin with setting that goal, the state of Buddhahood, it might be that when we train in steps of the path of those of the small scope, we'll become a genuine, full small scope being. Or that when we stay training in steps of the path of those of the medium scope, there's a danger that we will become a genuine or a fully qualified medium scope being. So that being the case, although when we train along the path of the Mahayana, in putting those instructions into practice, we begin with the stage of those of the small capacity. Still, we need to keep in mind that we're doing that so that we can attain the state of a Buddha. In order to do that, we must train in order, train in sequence. So we cycle in samsara repeatedly. Again and again, we take a rebirth in cyclic existence. And it seems that most of you, if not all of you, are already familiar with this sequence of teachings, in a sense that looking at the questions that came up in yesterday's session with Geshla, we had a Q&A session at the end of this, at the end of Geshla's teaching, it seems that by and large you are already familiar with the way that it works, right? You already know how it works within samsara. So we cycle repeatedly in cyclic existence. We take repeated rebirths, and we have no freedom in taking a rebirth, and through that the process we experience unbearable suffering. So we reflect upon it with respect to ourselves, and in that way we develop the determination to emerge from cyclic existence in seeing that this state is totally unbearable. Then what we need to do next is to turn and focus our attention to others and to see that just like us, they're caught in a similar situation, in the same situation, and on that basis we develop compassion towards them. So then when we look at the development of renunciation, the determination to emerge from samsara and compassion, we first of all develop the determination to emerge renunciation in finding our situation in samsara, taking a repeated rebirths without having any control, to be unbearable. And then we need to turn our attention to others and just as well find their suffering in samsara to be unbearable.
Quando noi riflettiamo nello stesso modo, ma lo riportiamo sugli altri, come anche tutti gli altri sono in questa situazione, quella che per noi è la mente dell'emersione definitiva diventa la compassione per gli altri.
So then In following our training along the Mahayana path, we take upon ourselves the burden of other sentient beings, in the sense that we take upon ourselves the responsibility for the welfare of other sentient beings. So then, in order to do that, we recognize that currently our current attitude is of a self-cherishing attitude, which is assisted by grasping at the self. And in fact, it has been the case for us since time without beginning and up until now. Since time without beginning and up until now, our mind has been so affected by our own attitude of cherishing ourselves that we cannot think of others by and large. In that, when we experience pain or sickness, our mind is totally burdened, is totally affected by our own problems and suffering. And yet, when others are suffering, experiencing pain, sickness, troubles, and so forth, we are not that affected by it. This is attributed to our degree of cherishing ourselves. So then, in training a man along the stairs of the Mahayana path, we train a man in taking the responsibility, the burden for the, of the welfare of other sentient beings, and we do that in applying ourselves to analytical meditation. So there are two methods that we use in our analytical meditation. One of them is a method that was passed on through the lineage of Maitreya, then to Asanga, which is a system of the sevenfold cause and effect personal instructions for developing bodhicitta. And the second method is the one that is affiliated with the lineage of Manjushri, passed on to Nagarjuna and Shantideva, the method of equalizing and exchanging self with others. So then, looking at those two methods, the first one, the sevenfold cause and effect personal instructions, this method is those of a lesser mental capacity or lesser mental fortitude, whereas the system of equalizing and exchanging self with others is for those who have a greater capacity, those whose mind stream is more vast and spacious, vast and extensive. And that being the case, it becomes a very powerful system. Now, it carries a great effect for taking upon oneself the burden of other sentient beings. So in training a man along the stairs of the Mahayana path, great compassion becomes the root of our training. And the glorious Chandrakirti emphasized that at the beginning of his supplement to the Middle Way, where he paid homage to great compassion. And he said that great compassion is important at the beginning, in the middle, and at the end. And that in the beginning, it is like a seed. In the middle, it is like the water and so forth that you provide the seed with in order to germinate and grow. And at the end, it is like the great harvest that is yielded. So then, in considering that great compassion is the root of bodhicitta, and it is important at the beginning, in the middle, and at the end. It is important at the beginning, for it is the root of the mind of enlightenment, and as such it is like the seed. It is important in the middle, because having developed bodhicitta, one still needs to make effort in training along the stairs of the Mahayana path, in training with the bodhisattva actions, bodhisattva deeds. So one needs still to be nourished by great compassion. Then at the end, without great compassion, a Buddha will not enact their activities, such as, for example, the 12 deeds of a Buddha, for the sake of other sentient beings. So compassion is also important at the end, also at the state of Buddhahood. So then we need to develop compassion. We've already established that. So then looking at the way that we go about in developing compassion through the system of the sevenfold cause and effect personal instructions, we develop the recognition that sentient beings have been our mothers. We then become mindful of the kindness. We develop the wish to repay the kindness. Then we develop affectionate love to sentient beings. And then we go on and develop compassion, which means that there are four preceding stages for the development of compassion through the first method. Looking at the second method, the one that was passed on through Nagarjuna and Shantideva, the practice of equalizing and exchanging self with others begins with equalizing self with others, which is a method for developing affectionate love, which means that juxtaposing or comparing those two methods that we have just mentioned, we have those steps, the initial steps in the practice of the Sevenfold Cause and Effect personal instructions, the first three or four stages, and then equalizing self with others in the second method. These two are methods for developing affectionate love, that loving kindness to other sentient beings.
Questi sono i passaggi essenziali di come avvengono a seconda delle due tecniche. No, succede.
Sono guardi la città mia, io mi sono guardato a prendere il cianvaso. Tanto è giunto, ma giunto il cianvaso, io mi sono guardato. Devo a prendere il cianvaso, è il cielo che è. Devo a prendere il cianvaso, non è da prendere il cianvaso, non è da prendere il cianvaso. Quando io mi sono guardato, chi è andato a fare il cuore, la metà delle sue cifre,
so then it's good also to emphasize that there is a difference between affectionate love and just love, in that when we look at that affectionate love that we develop through the practice of through those practices for developing bodhicitta, not only we have the wish for others to meet with happiness and to meet with happiness in the cause of happiness, this affectionate love, the word affection, is indicating that we need to find other sentient beings as being very pleasing to one's mind, very appealing to one's mind. So it's not a simple wish for them to be happy. We also want to find them appealing. We want to find them pleasing to our mind. So in order to do that, then it's important to begin with recognizing that sentient beings have been our mothers, in a sense that we know in the world in a very worldly way how a mother is very important to us, how a mother is so precious. You can say that, of course, a father is also important to us. And in fact, if you're able to develop that appreciation of other sentient beings and you find in finding them appealing, very pleasing to your mind, on the basis of thinking of your father, you know, if the end result would be the same, you can also reflect upon the kindness of your father. And yet, in some sense, we can think of how from young age we were cared for by a mother, and through that appreciate the kindness of our mother. Sorry, it is. So that a mother has taken care of us with such great care during the months of pregnancy, 9 months, avoiding certain foods and drinks. Also, after a birth, in the process of growing up, there was a great care that went into that process. So we develop an appreciation of the kindness of our mother, regardless of how beautiful she is or not beautiful. No, we have the sense of appreciation to her kindness. We find it completely agreeable to our mind. So then, in a very common way, we find a mother as being very pleasing to ourselves, to the point in which when a mother becomes sick, when there is a certain problem that she experiences, we develop that sense of urgency. There is, like, you know, we would say crisis or a certain sense of emergency that we experience on the mental level, and we feel that we have to do whatever we can. This is our responsibility to take care of our mother. So we take upon ourselves the responsibility for eliminating all the problems, all the pains, all the ailments of our mother. In that way, we start to act extensively for the sake of our mother. So in developing that attitude in which we take full responsibility for that, we develop what we call affectionate love, or love that find other sentient beings as pleasing to our mind, as being very appealing to our mind, because we consider them to be like our own beloved mother. So this is the type of attitude that we need to develop in developing that affectionate love, finding others as appealing to us.
Vuole che cos'è che responsabilità è quella di liberare tutti loro da tutte le loro sofferenze, ecco che in questo modo sorge la grande compassione. Per cui la radice è l'amore che vede la bellezza, lo so.
Now, in terms of the presentation of happiness and suffering in our Dhamma study and Dhamma practice, Geshe believes that we are already familiar with that, and yet it's important to mention that now we might have that affinity with teachings that speak about happiness, the development of compassion and happiness, and when we hear about suffering, it makes us unhappy. So in some sense, we might wish not to hear about suffering. We would like to hear about happiness, or we would like to be taught compassion. The word for compassion in Indian language, in Sanskrit, is karuna, which is also associated with the wish for others to be happy. So then we might have, you know, we might feel that this is something that we are more inspired by, but it's also important to hear about suffering. It is. So then it is important to think about suffering, because we recognize a situation as a situation of suffering, and we need to put an end to that suffering. And this is why the Buddha began by saying, teaching true suffering, and said that such and such constitute true suffering. So then in developing loving kindness, that affectionate love, we recognize sentient beings as being our mothers. We then become mindful of their kindness in following the initial steps of the Sevenfold Cause and Effect personal instructions. But then in order to follow those steps, we also then need to accept the existence of past and future lifetimes, which is a point that came up in yesterday's discussion. So we ought to, first of all, establish the existence of past and future lifetimes in order to follow those steps by which we recognize that sentient beings have been our mothers. So if we haven't really ascertained that with a valid cognition, we wouldn't have a very strong basis for following those steps of the practice. So what we're working towards is developing an understanding of a realization with valid cognition that past and future lifetime do exist. So in order to develop that, we rely upon reasonings, we rely upon proofs. So you could say that there are more proofs that support the existence of past and future lifetimes than proofs or reasoning that repudiate or that refute the existence of past and future lifetimes. There are more reasons that support that. You cannot say that because I do not see past lifetimes, they do not exist. No, this is not a valid reason. Just saying that because I don't see them, like, for example, in thinking of the many generations of the past, you know, where people have come and go, you cannot say that because I don't see the past lifetimes, they do not exist. Or because I do not see my past lifetimes, they do not exist. This is not a valid reason. So then in thinking of the proofs or the reasons that we can use it at our disposal for establishing the existence of past and future lifetimes, there are many of them. Now, one of them could be in terms of that those who have recollections of past lifetimes. So we can see in this world that those who remember past lives. Another reason is based on the continuity of consciousness. So when we think of our situation in this life, when we think of our mind or consciousness in this life, or for example the one of today, we can see that that came from our mind stream of yesterday, and that came from a mind that was there before, a continuity of consciousness. So then when we think of our stream of consciousness in this life and we trace it back to the point of birth, we can ask where did this consciousness come from. It had to have come from a previous life. So then when we think of the consciousness that is there at the time of birth, it needs to have come from a previous life. No, it did not come from the same mind of our mother. It did not arise all of a sudden. It came from a previous life. So if we then use many reasons in order to establish the existence and past and future lifetimes, if there is a previous life, there must have been also a life that came before that, a birth that was there before that, and the one that was before that. So we can thus establish that we have already been to countless rebirths. And in most of those rebirths, our mother has taken great care of us. There are certain states of existence, certain animals, for example, that you can see that they do not take care of their offsprings. Like, for example, a turtle might lay eggs and then go away, and the eggs hatch, and the mother doesn't take care of the baby turtles. But apart from those specific situations, mothers take care of their children, of their offspring. So then developing that recognition, we can then also think that actually all of us have our brothers and sisters that were born to the same mother before. So all of us are connected in this way. We are brothers and sisters that before were born to the same mothers. So you develop the sense of closeness to others through thinking about it. And when you think of being born to a mother before, if you think of a situation, for example, should you not see your mother for 30 years, and then after 30 years or 30 odd years, you have the opportunity to meet up with her, there would still be that great sense of closeness that you feel when you meet again with that person that is your mother. So similarly, when you think of other sentient beings that have been your mothers, that of the same family as you, right? You are of one family. In that, regardless of what their current state of mind is, what they think of at the moment, it could be that they even have some malicious state of mind. They have been your mother before. They belong to the same family as you. And in fact, those around you are brothers and sisters. They are of the same family that were born to one mother. So in thinking about it, we develop that sense of closeness between ourselves and others. And we also carry in our mind that responsibility for their welfare. Um, Geshe-la heard a story from one of his teachers at Drepung about a monk that was beating up a dog one day, you know, and there was someone else seeing that situation. He yelled out, "No, Amala, no Ama," which in Tibetan means mother, no, oh mother, which is indicative of putting it into practice and developing the recognition of others as being our mother. Even when you see a dog being beaten up, you can still hold on to that recognition that that has been your mother before. Currently, it might seem to us impossible to develop such attitude in our mind, but if we train our mind in stages, you would see that it is possible for that attitude, that recognition to arise in your mind. So if you begin with recognizing sentient beings as being your mother, and then you follow it up with reflecting upon the kindness of other sentient beings, naturally a wish to repay the kindness will arise in your mind. A well-mannered person, a person that of good behavior, reciprocates the kindness of others. If others were kind to that person, he will in turn act in a kind way to that person. So if you follow those stages in sequence, beginning with developing the recognition of mothers, then becoming mindful of their kindness, naturally, the wish to repair the kindness will arise in your mind. Now, looking at the other method for developing compassion and the Man of Enlightenment, the system of equalizing and exchanging self with others, we develop affectionate love to others. And if you develop it through that system, your mind becomes even more vast and extensive in your attitude of loving kindness. If you can think of sentient beings that were very kind to you and state of being your mother, that's good. But you can also think of the kindness of sentient beings even when you don't think of them as being your mothers. Particularly when you look at that from the perspective of the cycle of Dharma concerning the states of the path of those, the small scope as taught by the Buddha, the Bhagavan. The Buddha taught the ethical discipline that abstains from the 10 non-virtuous actions in this part of the teaching, those of the small scope. So we need to avoid those non-virtuous actions independent upon other sentient beings in relation to others, for an attitude of abstention can only be developed in relation to other, in that when you think of those 10 non-virtues such as killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and so forth, in order to develop an attitude of abstention, you need to do it independent on or in relation to others, without which, how will you be able to develop an attitude of abstention? So in this way, you can see that even if you don't think for the time being of sentient beings as being your mother, there is still a way of appreciating the kindness in, for example, providing you the ability, the possibility of guarding ethical discipline. So in this way, you can say that the develop of affectionate love or that loving kindness within the system of equalizing and exchanging yourself with others is more effective. So then when we think of the kindness of others, how others were so greatly kind to us, we can think about it in with respect to what exists within our body, right? Our internal body. And we can think about it also with respect to enjoyments and resources that we have of clothing and food and dwellings and so forth. All of them came through to us through the kindness of others. The food that we eat, you know, Geshe-la was looking at its robes and said, I cannot produce those robes, I cannot make them. They came about through the kindness of others. Now, what I eat is there because of the kindness of others. So you then might be thinking that, you know, what do you mean it came to me through the kindness of others? I paid for it. No, I have money. I paid for it. So it's not that others were kind to me in providing that with me, providing me with those things. Well, even if you think about it like that, if you think of having a lot of money, a lot of things in your disposal, if there are no others to provide you with those services, you will still not be able to have them. It might be difficult to think about it when you consider this environment in Italy. It seems that even when you travel to this area, which is surrounded by fields and forests and so forth, there are still quite a few enjoyments or resources that you can get independent upon your money. But you know, if you think of traveling, for example, in Tibet, where you have many desolated places, you know, something that is completely dry and a piece of land that is completely dry, so if you get to this place that is completely desolate and you have a lot of money, it still will not be able to get you what you need. So you can think in that way of the kindness of others. You might then think in that, what do you mean I need to appreciate the kindness? They did not have the thought of benefiting me. They did not have the intention to benefit me. Well, we can also answer that in saying that, well, the food that you eat, the house that you live in, is something that supports you, that benefits you, without the intention to be helpful to you. So if it is helpful to you, if it benefits you, does it necessarily need to have the wish to do that? Certainly not.
Thank you.
So when we think of also other practices, such as, for example, generosity, we have different types of generosity. Generosity of giving material things, generosity of giving the Dhamma, generosity of giving protection from fear. All those different types of generosity are contingent upon others. Their practice depends upon others. So others provide you with the opportunity to be generous. Then you have the practice of ethics and the practice of patience. With the practice of patience, we consider situations in which an ill will, a malicious intent arises in your mind when others, for example, harm you. Now, you come to see them as enemies and you get angry at them. Patience is a state in which we arrest anger, like a state of mind in which anger is arrested. And through patience, our mind becomes courageous. We develop mental fortitude with patience. So you can do that only with an enemy, with someone that is very close to you, a friend. You cannot develop that fortitude in which you have thereby put a stop to anger. It can only be done in depends upon an enemy. So that is with respect to patience. And we can also add to that the view, right? So when we develop the view, the absence of inherent existence, we can also develop that in the case of a situation where we get angry with another person. So we might entertain the thought that, no, that person did this to me and they did that to me, how dare they have done that thing to me. In the process of getting angry with that person, when we then develop a recognition of the view, we can start to look for the object of our anger and say that upon that investigation and analysis, we cannot find the object of our anger. So again, with that, we can sustain a greater degree of patience in recognizing that the object of our anger is not found within a recent analysis, so that your mind becomes more vast and spacious and it becomes more courageous with a greater degree of fortitude. So all of these practices for developing your mind are also contingent upon the kindness of others.
Anche nel contesto della pratica della pazienza, è grazie all'atto che possiamo praticare la pazienza utilizzando l'analisi della vacuità, pensando come io non esisto assolutamente, nessun fenomeno esiste intrinsecamente esistente, anche questa persona che sembra così oggettivamente al di fuori di me, che mi sta contrastando, se la cerco nella sua base di imputazione, non la trovo, completamente priva di mia resistenza. In quel momento, per cui l'animosità, la rabbia e tutte queste cose scompaiono completamente. Questo è possibile a causa di che? A causa della persona, di quella persona, per cui che questo dipende dal nemico, no? Succede.
Non è un
So then, those practices, generosity and so forth that we've mentioned in this context, you can say that they are branches, they are necessary branches, but really we also need to sustain the view, the philosophical view, with the practice of equalizing and exchanging self with others. So when we practice equalizing, exchanging self with others, our sustaining of the view becomes crucial. It becomes crucial because of the way that the self appears to one's mind and others appear to one's mind. Geshe-la drew from Dharmakirti's Pramanavartika, the compendium of valid cognition, in which, although Dharmakirti did not speak in that verse, he did not use the terms of inherent existence or not existing truly and so forth, we can still use the verse from the Pramanavartika in seeing how there is a sense of selfhood that appears to oneself and a sense of otherness that appears to one's mind, and they appear in a way that seems to be unrelated, independent, right? Selfhood and otherness appear to one's mind as being so there's a sense of selfhood and otherness that appears to one's mind as being unrelated and independent, but they exist only in depending upon each other, in relation to each other, which is also what Lama Tsongkhapa mentioned in his praises to the Dependent Arising. He said that whatever is produced by cause and condition is empty. When you see that, can't remember the exact words of the verse in English, I'll look for it in a minute, but whatever is produced by cause and condition is empty. And this is the middle way. Anyway, find this verse in a second. What Lama Tsongkhapa mentioned in that verse is the relationship between dependent arising and empty, and that whatever exists independence on and in relation to other does not exist from its own side, does not exist inherently, does not exist truly. Sorry, I think that this verse actually is from Nagarjuna's Root of Wisdom, not from... Anyway, I'll find it later. So this is really important to see that dependency between oneself and others, to say that we are not unrelated, we are not independent. We do exist independent on in relation to others. So in whatever way you're going to think about it, if you think of the entity, the nature of oneself and others, if you think about it in terms of cause and conditions, you can see that whatever you seek to attain, be it the state of liberation, be it a set of omniscience, it all depends upon the kindness of others. If you seek to attain some happiness in this life, it depends upon others. So it is not that the way that oneself and other appeal to one's mind is correct. It's not that we exist independently in a way that is unrelated to each other. We exist only in dependence on and in relation to others. So then Yuzhonis also says, with respect to that, that when we think of ourselves, it seems to us that there is only one individual me, there is only one me, but when you think of others, you can come to recognize that they are countless, limitless sentient beings. So also considering that in terms of numbers, you can come to appreciate the importance of others that are much more important than just one single individual. So then when you think about it like that, you know, you think about it for a year or two, you see that your mind starts to transform bit by bit. Currently, our mind is so entrenched in thinking of ourselves alone and not considering others. But if you think about those reasoning for some time, for a year or two or more, then your apprehension of I or me will become more loose, it will become more relaxed, and your mind will be able to then consider others to a greater degree. And a mental transformation will occur in this way, where you will start to exchange your attitude of cherishing yourself. You start to exchange your attitude of cherishing yourself with an attitude of cherishing other sentient beings. So within the practice of equalizing and exchanging self with others, the exchanging of self with others is done in this way. You exchange your attitude of cherishing yourself with an attitude of cherishing other sentient beings and thinking about the reasons that we have just mentioned. So in this way you develop affectionate love, loving kindness to other sentient beings. And if you do it in the way that Geshe-la mentioned, that attitude will easily arise in your mind. And then when you develop that affectionate love to others, you can also take into cognizance that sentient beings are tormented by suffering, a variety of suffering, and on that, on the basis of that recognition, compassion will arise towards them. So when we think of developing compassion with respect to suffering sentient beings, those which are beset by suffering, the thing that immediately comes to mind is the first stuff of suffering, suffering of suffering. But in actual fact, in order to develop that adequate sense of compassion, what we need to consider is the third type of suffering, which is called pervasive suffering of conditionality. It is so hard to develop an understanding of the third type of suffering, pervasive suffering of conditionality. But you give it some thought. You look at it from different perspectives, and at some point when you get it, you then can have a real estimate of how sentient beings are tormented by suffering. And you're so affected by it in a sense that you can see the graveness of the situation of others, how sentient beings are seriously beset by suffering. So when you're thus affected so deeply by the notion of sentient beings experiencing pervasive, or having, sorry, pervasive suffering of conditionality, you then think that this is my responsibility, my burden to free them from suffering. So then you start to think, have I got the ability to liberate sentient beings from that suffering? You recognize that currently you don't have that ability, for you do not have the knowledge of the different dispositions of other sentient beings. But should you have the knowledge of the disposition of others, you will be able to do that. So you develop the wish to become a Buddha in order to know the disposition of others, to liberate them from suffering. So, compassion is considered to be like the mother, in that when considered that from the perspective of the sevenfold cause and effect personal instructions, the causes that come before compassion, by which one generates compassion, and then the results of compassion, which are the wholehearted resolve, which is also called the highest intention, and after that bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. So they are considered to be sourced or based on the root, on the mother, which is compassion. So it is then so important to develop compassion, and also in that process to enact the blessings of compassion, which is also illustrated by accounts and biographies of excellent masters. Like, for example, when Atisha traveled to Tibet, there were many scholars that were active at the time in Tibet, already Buddhist scholars, and we should think that there were also bodhisattvas living in Tibet at that time. And yet the situation was such that many were engaged in erroneous Dharma practices, which was actually not considered to be Dharma practice. There were severe misconceptions with respect to Dharma, and Atisha was able to vanquish many of them through the blessings, through the force of the blessings of compassion. There's another story that Geshe-la taught concerning one of his teachers from Japan, which happened to be also one of the teachers of His Honest the Dalai Lama. The teacher is Nyingma Gyantsen, and it is said that at the time where he still resided in Tibet, one day appeared one mantrika, a mantra practitioner that came up from Nepal, and he was staying somewhere in that area, and it seems that he was possessed by a demon. It seems that a demon took possession of him. So someone called this teacher, Nyoma Gyaltsen, to aid that person. And Nyoma Gyaltsen approached that person. He was considering what to do. So at the beginning, he thought, I will do a practice of Yamantaka Vajrabhava, meditating on the completion, the generation stage and the completion stage of Yamantaka Vajrabhava in the presence of that person that is possessed by a demon. He thought that, this is a really unfortunate situation. That person has done some mantra practice without having put into practice the common paths. So it is really difficult because a malevolent attitude can arise in the mind of that person. They could be possessed by demon due to not having developed the common paths in the mindstream. So he thought that rather than doing the practice of Vajrabhava, the generation, the completion stage, he could meditate on compassion in the presence of that person. So he meditated on compassion, and that person has become completely quiet or completely pacified. So that indicates the blessings of compassion. So, Geshe-la wanted to first of all speak about these points in relation to the stress of the path of the great scope, and then going back to what we've covered yesterday, we've started to look at the text. We have looked at the point of teaching the greatness of the author of this text, and then we started to cover the section of the greatness of the teachings. So, it is important to cover the first part, and yesterday Rinpoche, Kabje Rinpoche, was speaking of Atisha in relation to appreciating the greatness of the author of the text. It's important to go through that section. It is important, it is relevant to our Dhamma practice. It is not difficult to really look at the love story of Atisha, right? It's not something that we'll find it difficult to get our head around, but we can just look at the love story and through that come to appreciate Atisha, and through that to establish that this is an authoritative source of teaching, that this is a valid source of teachings. When you come to recognize Atisha, you can recognize the inconceivable qualities that Atisha had, and thereby develop faith in Atisha. So there's this, you can say that there is a chain reaction that will be developed. You will appreciate the qualities of Atisha, find them inconceivable. Faith will arise in your mind. Then from faith arises striving or seeking. No, this is the aspiration. So then you will seek the teachings. So it's really important to go through those stages. And particularly it's also important to appreciate how hard those scholars of the past have worked before in Tibet, not only those great scholars, but also the kings of Tibet. They have worked so hard, and we enjoy now the fruit of the hard work. How many people were involved in that hard work? When you think of how we commute to different places nowadays, you know, we might take a train, an airplane, and so forth, and we'll quickly or easily get to a certain destination. All those means did not exist at the past in Tibet. Those people have traveled far and wide in bringing teachings to Tibet, and they have worked so hard. So many people were involved in that process. And now we enjoy all those good conditions, those conducive conditions that support our Dhamma study and practice. So we ought to think that those excellent masters of the past have worked so hard to do it, and we have to do whatever we can in order, when we have the opportunity, the conditions to enjoy that. So, recapping what we've covered yesterday with respect to the life story of Atisha, we said that Atisha was born into a royal family. He lived as a prince in a princely, in a royal court. At some point, he renounced his princely life and he sought ordination. There is an account in the Lamrim Chemo accounting for what Atisha studied and the masters that Atisha relied upon. He studied the perfection system, the Paramitayana, for 12 years. Then he relied upon a teacher that is called Rahula Gupta, from which he received instructions on the Madhyamika, the middle way system. He traveled across the seas, enduring many difficulties in seeking instructions on the mind of enlightenment from Lama Silimpa, the Lama from Sumatra. And in that way, he became a master of scripture, possessing many qualities of scriptures, as well as many qualities of realizations. It was also said in this, our text of the Test of the Path that one of Lama Salimpa's, one of Atisha's teacher, Srila Rakshita, was someone who has attained the path of preparation. So since yesterday a question came up with respect to the path of preparation, Geshe-la thought of linking it up here with this point in the text. So we said yesterday that there are four stages to the path of preparation. There is the heat, peak, forbearance, and supreme and then quality. And Just a second, I'll try to find the exact point in the text. Anyway, found it, so we can continue. So along those four stages of the path of preparation, one suppresses some conceptions of true existence, right? And there, those stages are referred to by different terms. Now, the terms I'm using might be different to the terms that you're using here in your study program in Italy, but let's go with that. So so the first stage was suppressing a one-sided suppression of conception of true existence with respect to the that which is apprehended. So in order to understand that, we can first of all speak of apprehended and apprehender, or object and subject. We have conceptions of true existence, grasping a true existence with respect to objects, and we have conception of true existence with respect to subject. It is much easier to suppress those conceptions of true existence with respect to an object. In like, for example, if you have something in front of you, like a mug or a cup, and it breaks, no, it smashes, no, you might become distressed or irritated with respect to that. This is an external object, so to speak. And it is easier than to suppress those conceptions of true existence with respect to that object. Then there is the subject that apprehends that object. It is, you know, in following that explanation, you might say that it is, you might, if that object is smashed or it is broken, you might get angry at it, you know, for being ineffectual anymore, being unhelpful anymore. It is more difficult to become upset or irritated with yourself, or that irritation of becoming upset with yourself would be lesser than getting upset with an external object. So Gessler is using that explanation in order to say that it is easier to suppress conceptions of true existence with respect to what is apprehended, an object, than suppressing conceptions of true existence with respect to the apprehender, a subject. So let's link it up with the stages of the path of preparation. We say that the first stage is heat. So on the stage of heat, you have one-sided suppression of conceptions of true existence in relation to objects, in relation to what is apprehended.
È più facile diminuire la concezione di resistenza sull'oggetto che sul soggetto. È più facile, è più debole. Per cui questo che cosa vuol dire? Vuol dire che aveva eliminato la concezione, aveva la considerazione che realizza la mancanza di resistenza o di essenza intrinseca dell'oggetto, ma non ancora quello del soggetto, per cui aveva la concentrazione solo su una parte della realtà, ok? Questo è il significato. No,
Okay. It is said that Atisha possessed superior vows of individual liberation and the way that he guarded his ethical discipline, having sought ordination, right? So he became ordained. The way that he guarded his ethical discipline is explained in page 38, towards the bottom of the page. He said that a yak is so attached to the hairs of its tail that when a single hair gets caught in brush, it will risk its life to guard that no hair be lost, even if it sees that it might be killed by a hunter. Likewise, Atisha, after receiving the complete vows of a monk, guarded the risk of his life, every minor fundamental training, not to mention the major fundamental trainings to which he was committed. Therefore, as it is said in Matsu's 80 verses of prayer, he was an elder who was great upholder of the text and discipline. So this section illustrates Atisha's ethical discipline in relation to his vow. So Atisha was ordained, right? So he had the ethics of ordination, the ethical discipline of ordination. On top of that is the text tesis. He also obtained the Bodhisattva vow, and within that he had to guard the vow in the framework of practicing generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, absorption, and wisdom, those perfections. On top of that, he also has obtained the mantra vow. So when you attend the mantra or the tantra vow, you have the tantric vow. You also have pledges that come together with that, and you then take up the practice of the generation stage and the completion stage. So there are quite a lot of vows and commitments that one needs to guard in relation to that. It is said that Atisha himself said that with respect to his Pratimoksha vow, the first layer of vow, the first class of vow, he should think that it doesn't incur infractions with respect to his ordination vow, the vow of the Pratimoksha vow. With respect to the Bodhisattva vow, sometimes, every once in a while, it has an infraction. But then with respect to the Tantric vow, he said that he has so many infractions that he incurs with respect to it. So that also indicates to us something with respect to the way that we approach the taking of vow. You know, when an empowerment is given together with a vow, we often rush to take it without really thinking about it. So if you look at the tanka on the right hand side, we have a tanka of Atisha, and to the right of Atisha there is a stupa. So there is a story that is connected with that stupa. It is said that as Atisha was traveling to Tibet, whenever he incurred an infraction with respect to any of the vow that he possessed, either the vow of the Pratimoksha vow or the Bodhisattva vow or the Tantric vow, he immediately disembarked and prostrated to that stupa and laid down his negativity through a process of confession by which the four antidotal powers were present. So the stupa was used as in relation to a certain basis that Atisha purified his negativity. So this stupa traveled to Tibet together with Atisha. It was said that it was held in a monastery that is called Tuling Monastery, Tuling Gomba. When China took over Tibet, following the uprising in Tibet, someone managed to smuggle that stupa out of Tibet, rescue that stupa, and it carried it with him to Mongun, and it was given to a certain family at Mongun settlement, which still retains that stupa. Now, they promised maybe at a certain point to give it to a Drepung, but it's still there. It's still in their possession. Sorry, I kind of missed that. I think that what Geshe-la was saying is that on the other side there is a bag for something maybe to put a stupa. Kind of I missed what Geshe-la said. I'll get it later. Apologize for that. Also, there's a section that describes what Atisha did in relation to his tantric practice. It is said that he meditated on himself as a deity. So it's not, when we think of that meditation on oneself as a deity following the generation stage and completion stage, it's not that this contaminated, appropriate aggregate is what becomes the body of a deity. It is rather that one meditates on emptiness, first of all, dissolving the contaminated, appropriated aggregate into an empty state. And the wisdom realizing emptiness itself arises as a deity. So it seems that Geshe-la took the time today to explain that. So we might have only 10 minutes left. If you got any questions, please put your hand up. So Kyabjali Rinpoche, the previous one, came here 38 years ago. Now we have the reincarnation of Kyabjali Rinpoche. So, the question is there any relation between the appearance and the behavior, the physical behavior of the current Rinpoche and the one before the previous reincarnation. So, no. Geshe-la said that this is something that Ling which I need to be asked, the current Ling which I need to be asked. So with respect to the connection between the previous Ling Rinpoche and the current Ling Rinpoche, whether you know it is that similar in terms of their behavior, or in terms of their appearance, you know, Geshe-la said that this is something that we might need to take up with Ling Rinpoche himself. But anyway, regardless of that, a while ago, many years ago, there was someone making a documentary about reincarnations in India. So they, in that process of research, they interviewed His Honor and Dalai Lama. And His Honor said that there were two reincarnations, two yangtzes. This is the word that is used in Tibetan, yangtze. Two of them that are unmistaken. One of them was Ling Rinpoche, and one of them was the reincarnation of the abbot of Drepung, Pemba Gyatsen. Both of them were around the same age, and His Honor said with a great degree of certainty that they are unmistaken yangtzes, unmistaken reincarnation. There's another account of the way that the current Kyabje Ling Rinpoche, the seventh one, was found. So after the death of the previous Ling Rinpoche, at some point a search party was formed to look for the reincarnation of Kyabje Ling Rinpoche. So they were looking for small children that were born in a certain year, right? So they they need to have been born in a certain year, having a certain sign, you know, the astrological sign of that year, according to the Deben system. There was also someone more specific that they were looking for that was bearing a certain name. So they were looking around, they were visiting. They were visiting a school at Bir, and they didn't find a child that matched that description. The people that were involved in that research were Rinpoches from Drepung Monastery, Jampa Rinpoche and another Rinpoche, and they were looking for a certain child that bared a certain name, you know, from a certain year, having a certain astrological sign. The child was not found at Bir. Now, Lingpoche's mother died when Lingpoche was at a very young age, and subsequently was sent to the TCV at Dharamsala, which also acts as, you could say, like is a sort of an orphanage, it's a children village. So he was residing at the time at the TCV at Dharamsala. Now, the people that came to look for the reincarnation collected a few candidates, right? So they were looking for candidates, and to be continued. Stay tuned. So they came to look for that child in the TCV, and they had a few candidates, and the people that came, you know, with the search party were the attendant and the secretary of the previous Lingpoche. So they were walking to the office, and there was one child that kind of was, you know, children assembled together, and one of the child took the attendant's hand, you know, so they were walking hand in hand. So he got to the office and asked, you know, where's the list of kids that we need to see today? And at the office, he was told, well, it's that kid that is holding your hand now. No, that was Lingpoche. No, so he recognized his attendant and his secretary from his previous year and was already attached to them. There's another story about a guy that had a factory for making sweaters, like a wool factory, making carpets or sweater or something like that. And he used to come around when Lingpoche was young and to play with him and, you know, just to, you know, have a bit of a play. At some point, Lingpoche said that, you know, you really ought to be careful about your factory, about your workshop, because there's a danger that it could go up in flame one day, you know. Make sure that, you know, you lock your factory, that you keep it orderly, because there's the danger of catching fire. Now, a year later, there was a cricket match that was held between India and Pakistan. One of the spectators was a Tibetan guy that was cheering for the Pakistani team. No, so he was spotted cheering for the Pakistani team, and in an Indian rage, some people went into town and set fire to a few shops. One of them was the workshop of that person. No, so it was completely engulfed with fire. And all of a sudden, the owner of the shop remembered that a year before, now Lingpoche said that, you know, careful, you need to be careful about your possessions, about, you know, about your money, because there's a danger that one day your shop will go up in flame. So no further questions?
Vishnu se può specificare ancora cos'è l'amore che vede la bellezza e come diventa compassione.
Io ti chiamo da Villa Crema di Nige, Nige che è scritto a
So the question is with respect to a brief explanation of how compassion arises from affectionate love. So the question is with respect to the way in which compassion arises from affectionate love and that the sequence of practice. So remember that we spoke about love, not only it's just love, but that affectionate love in which you find others as being appealing to you, appealing to your mind. So if you develop that affectionate love, then when you thereby observe the suffering of others, you see how others are tormented by suffering, you develop compassion towards them. No, and you develop that great compassion towards them because you have a sense of closeness to them as you see them appealing to your mind. It is different to the way that we might observe currently someone that is affected by suffering. We might think that, alas, or that person is in such a pitiful state, but the mind would not be that greatly affected by that state. And the reason for that is that we do not find that person as being that appealing to our mind, or that we don't have that sense of affection to that person. So when we think about the development of affectionate love towards others and in which we find them appealing to our mind, we can develop in the way that we can. It can also be sustained with respect to an enemy, which is not someone you can say that in an ultimate sense we find completely unappealing. So if we're able to train a mind in finding another person as appealing, we might be able even to see an enemy in hardware to be someone that is very kind to us. We might also see them with a sense of closeness. Now, Geshe-la now said that the questions and answers, that discussion is also very important because you could say that in some sense it bears the attributes of a debate that one might have.
Sangye shingdu mikte uwagi Joko namda shinla che pashu Idam guru ranna mandala kam niyatayami Gewadi nyodudang lama sangye rumgyone Drowa chinkya malupa deye salangu pashu Janchup semchok rinpoche Makye panam gengyu chi Kyepa nyampa mepaya Gone gondru pelwashu